Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and one of the 12 people murdered over the weekend in Chicago. His name is Earl Young. Sometimes it's not about gangbanging. It's just sort of about a culture, a cultural problem. I mean, do you ever think that maybe people are beyond reason, that they just can't be reached?
Yes.
Well,
I feel that way with people that are really insanely crazy. It's like you can't reason with crazy. So you have to do the best you can and move on.
So here's the story of Earl Young in South Shore.
Young was murdered Friday, one of 12 killed over the violent weekend. Payne says it all stemmed from Young's two puppies on the porch of his South Shore home.
And the puppies were peeing on the porch. And the pee ran down the porch into the neighbors.
Police say Young and the neighbor below exchanged words. Then Young was shot and killed. He was 30.
How petty are we now that we're living in a world that you could lose your life over puppy pee?
How petty indeed.
Hashtag puppy pee.
Yeah.
Well, take it to the yard. But, I mean, you don't, that's ridiculous. Did they arrest the person at least because they know that the neighbor shot him because of the puppy pee?
No one has been arrested.
The dog peed on his porch, and hence the motive for the murder, and now we have a hashtag puppy pee.
No one has been arrested. Hey. And and what do we get from the Chicago Press Corps? Tough talk about tough talk. Rex Hupke. He's just a fungible leftist who writes these pointless op-eds for the Tribune. All talk politicians should shut up about Chicago violence. They're not helping. Hey, all you Illinois politicians and political candidates scrambling to condemn this past weekend's outbreak of gun violence, please shut up. Tough talk about tough talk. Tiny Dancer is dispatching hundreds of additional police officers into the neighborhoods overwhelmed by recent shootings, and that's good. He speaks with emotion I believe is insincere. Aren't you cute, Rex Hupke? The tough-talking politicians have to shut up, except for Rahm Emanuel, who's sincere. And I don't envy him the burden of being in charge of a city so violent. Well, nobody forced him to take the job. Rex Hupke's tough talk. They don't come forward talking about witnesses to, say, a neighbor who's murdered over puppy pee. They don't come forward because they're scared and don't trust the police. And a lot of that is on you, Mr. Mayor, because you're running the show. Ooh, tough talk, Rex. And what does he demand? He talks exactly like the politicians he's telling to shut up. How about a comprehensive plan?
Okay.
How about putting neighborhoods that are hope vacuums and dead body factories ahead of improvements to the Riverwalk? Okay. How about something besides a press conference when the heat gets turned up after a particularly bad weekend? Uh-huh.
Well, at a press conference yesterday, Governor Rahner said that he is not calling up the Illinois National Guard because they are used in riot situations only.
Right. I mean, this is not a new call. This is not a new problem.
No.
That's not a new response. I agree. I don't think the National Guard is appropriate here. is the National Guard going to have more of a trust relationship with the populace than do Chicago police, if that's the issue? I mean, in other words, if you want to tell me these are the issues, then connect them to the response. So what's the problem the National Guard solves that we otherwise don't have the capacity to solve at the local level? What is it? That, I mean, more guys with guns? We got 12,000 guys with guns in uniform. That's not enough? If it's not enough, then I guess we have to hire more guys in uniform.
And maybe more detectives, too, because that seems like we solved that murder of the puppy pee.
Yeah, it would be nice, too, if the message was sent that we can solve the puppy pee murder, so that people know that actually they cannot act with impunity, that they'll go away and never be heard from again. It'd be nice if one of these murders, some of these shootings, would be solved to send a message to those people that supposedly don't trust the police, because what are they doing? And what are the politicians doing? What's Rex Hupke doing? He's on the side of the gangbangers. They're on the side of the murderers. They want to talk about everything other than holding these people accountable for what they've done. They want to talk about everything other than demanding some accountability from every single household in the city, including in these neighborhoods. They're on the side of the murderers. They want to talk about police violence and police trust. Police are the problem. Guns are the problem. Okay. I got to think that, and we'll ask LaShawn Ford, state rep from the West Side, at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. I got to think that some of these gangbangers sit back and watch and hear from politicians and op-ed writers in this town, and they just have to laugh. They just have to laugh at how stupid they are and how much they're getting over on these people in charge of solving problems and thinking big thoughts. Lewis in Dayton, Texas, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Danny. How are you doing this morning?
Good.
I was trying to come up with a solution. I think a solution for some of the problems in Chicago might actually be a camera system like they do with our cousins across the pond. You know, I mean, you have cameras, you know, populate cameras in some of these high crime areas.
We have cop in a box cameras all over the place. We do.
I haven't been to Chicago in a while, so.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, over there, they normally have cameras on every street. And when a criminal gets away, they can kind of follow them around the city over in Britain and stuff like that. I was thinking maybe a similar system might help here. But like you guys also say, too, it's not only the systems in government. I think, you know, a big part of it, too, is the people. The people need to start being more involved. I understand they're scared and afraid, but these are the tactics that these criminals and gangbangers use to keep doing their crimes. I think if the people got involved a lot more, I think a lot less of these crimes would happen, you know, because they know that these individuals in these neighborhoods wouldn't be as afraid to come forward and to, you know, kind of, I guess, rat them out, so to speak.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Lewis. We have the technology. We're missing something else.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, taking a couple more of your calls on the man killed over dog pee and other Chicago-related violence.
I still can't believe that no arrests have been made.
Yeah, you think you'd be able to zero in on the neighbor at this little apartment complex pretty quickly.
You know where he lives. He's right underneath them.
Rick on the West Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning, Dan and Amy. Listen, I have my business on the West Side. Yesterday morning, I came to work and they had Lake Street all cordoned off. It was a running gun battle down Lake Street, which eventually ended when the driver of the van got shot and a couple of people in the van got shot. I think there's four people in there, three of them got killed. But I opened up yesterday sometimes and I seen a picture of Danny Gatiss, who represents this district, congressional district in this neighborhood and in West Side. And he's begging for more money. And these guys, his niece was just sent to prison for 6 or 8 years for embezzling money from a state grant, from a federal grant, which I'm sure Danny Davis procured for her.
Danny Davis.
The only way you're going to get rid of this problem is by getting rid of the politicians.
All right. Thanks for the call, Rick. Did Danny Davis was his grandson or nephew? What was it?
His niece.
He had a family member who was murdered, though.
Oh, that was Bobby Rush.
Didn't
Bobby
Danny
Rush's
Davis,
son was murdered.
Didn't Danny Davis
he was
have
a hairdresser?
Yes, but I thought Danny Davis had a relative who was murdered.
Yes, he did. We'll find. Yeah,
yeah,
he did.
He did, and so the question to Danny Davis was that a money problem? The unfortunate murder that visited your family, that a money problem? Money have solved that?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11 right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Just resetting the table. We were talking about Chicago violence and one of the stories from this past weekend of the 12 murdered. It was a young man named Earl Young, and here's what happened in his case, the source of the confrontation that led to his death. Puppy pee, no joke.
Young was murdered Friday, one of 12 killed over the violent weekend. Payne says it all stemmed from Young's two puppies on the porch of his South Shore home.
And the puppies were peeing on the porch. And the pee ran down the porch into the neighbors.
Police say Young and the neighbor below exchanged words. Then Young was shot and killed. He was 30.
How petty are we now that we're living in a world that you could lose your life over puppy pee?
How petty are we? Man's puppy inhumanity to man.
And the thing is that no one has been arrested in Mr. Young's murder. And that is outrageous. That's ridiculous. You have the motive. You have a witness. And you have the location of the gunman because he lives underneath the victim.
Yeah, he may not have stayed around to wait for police to catch up to him.
He might not have, but
I assume that this shouldn't be the most difficult case in the world to crack.
It's not like we have to call Nancy Drew on this one, you know?
Right, and probably doesn't have the means to, you know, escape to a non-extradition treaty country and so on and so forth. We should be able to wrap this one up, I would hope. 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA turnkey.pro text line, the intersection between petty and violent. Steve and Joliet, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. You mentioned one thing that is missing. The other caller spoke about surveillance monitoring in England. One thing we all miss is missing from the individuals is the courage. That's the courage to get involved. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. Yeah, courage is in short supply in this city and state, generally speaking. It's a cultural failure. We outsource everything to the government. We're the most government-centric state in the country. Maybe
Rhode Island's close second.
Nobody's a close second.
No one.
Not on the numbers and not on the culture. I had this conversation before. I recall this conversation before. This guy I was talking to who's like a sales rep for a big manufacturing concern. He has like 13 states, Midwest to the South. And he made the point, he's not from Chicago. And he said, it's interesting about Chicago. He said, you guys talk about politics here more than all of the other states I go to, big cities I go to, combined.
Wow.
And that's an interesting perspective. Because what it tells you is politics insinuates itself in all aspects of our lives here. It's poisonous. And that we're a government-centric state. So we have dependents and supplicants and, feudal lords. That's a bad combination. It's a bad way to structure a free society. But that's really so key to this. In addition to sort of the incubators of all of these unproductive, violent, deadly behavior, which is families that are absent in the lives of children and a terrible, terrible school system. Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, Amy, I'm totally with you. We had, on Palm Sunday morning, a shooting here in Jefferson Park. I was right down the street, and the car that got shot, two bullet holes in the car. Apparently, the guy was stopping for his to see his ex-girlfriend. Somebody came out of the house shooting at the car. The car got in an accident down the street. There was cop cars all over the place, police all over, and I talked to one of them, and they said they found two bullets basically at the porch of the house that did the shooting. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that probable cause to, you know, go in the house, kick the door down, if you will, to go in the house and find a gun and all this stuff? Because I guess the people there were uncooperative, and of course, nothing's happened as a result of this.
Uncooperative. Yeah, I'd say you're right. Thanks for the call, Greg. Somebody comes out of a house shooting, and then they go back in the house and say, no, we're not going to cooperate? Well, I'm sorry. You've flexed your muscles. You ceded that right to not cooperate. You don't have to cooperate. We're going to come in and take you to the pokey. Hey.
Why are we so light and so nice to the criminals?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's the instinct of Chicago police to be nice to the criminals, but this goes again to these sort of underlying cultural norms and failures. And one of them is what? Police don't have the backing of the civilian political authorities, so they're hesitant to act. And by the way, you don't think the Predators know that?
No, they know.
Tony on the south side.
Not all criminals are stupid.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Me, Piola Bella. Listen.
Hey, Tony.
Here's the problem. The justice system. Dan, you hit it right on the head. You talk about it all the time. I don't hear it nowhere else. It's the justice system in this freaking city, right? Remember back in the day, the 60s and 70s? How did the FBI take down the mob? They infiltrated it. They got information. They made arrests. They brought people in. They were prosecuted or put in jail. You don't have that here. And I want to point out something else, too. You know, this whole puppy pee caper. Not once did I hear anybody in the news media mention the alleged neighbor. Not a name at all, right? So that just shows you what this whole system is. It comes from the media. It comes from, like you said, the feudal lords, which I love that word. And, of course, the justice system that we have here. It's broken. It's never going to be fixed. That's all I needed to say.
All right. Thanks for the call, Tony. Pete in Montgomery.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. Yeah, after those previous phone calls, I think my idea is kind of stupid. But my idea here is breaking up the police command center, purchasing or taking by eminent domain some of these abandoned houses throughout these neighborhoods and staffing the police at those spots. So there's a permanent presence in these high crime neighborhoods on the blocks, in the streets of a police force.
Well, that's interesting.
But if they're not going to arrest anybody, then it's kind of pointless to do that.
Well, yeah, although it isn't. I mean, rehab some of these burned out houses or drug houses that the city owns as well. I mean, you either raise them or you put them to some good use, I suppose. That's an interesting thought. I mean,
what they did in Detroit, they raised all the houses and now there's organic farming.
Well, I know, but what he's saying is, so that's one way to do it, but in terms of police presence in the neighborhoods, in these specific neighborhoods, I don't know, you know, who's going to want to volunteer to live in some of these neighborhoods as a Chicago police officer, but it's an interesting idea.
I'm not talking about living in there. I'm talking about turning them into satellite police
stations. I see what you're saying. Yeah. I don't know.
A couple, 25 officers in one, that rotate through one house, on their shifts, and they're always there. And there's a detective who runs it, so they know all the people in that area. So they know who the perpetrators are, but now they're there to see it, and then they're also a deterrent.
Yeah.
Satellite fortresses, basically.
I don't think it's crazy. I mean, not to, reference something that's fictional, but, if you saw the series The Wire.
Yeah,
they sort of did something like that when they were targeting Avon Barksdale's gang. Yeah, get Stringer Bell. He was too smart for them, though. Pete, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. It's interesting. We talk about police presence in the neighborhoods. It's interesting that I don't live there, but, you know, use it as a satellite office during your shift, so you're always there. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Amy and Dan, and good to see you last night, Amy. Question for Dan. Can you confirm this number? Yesterday I was listening to Joe Walsh's program, and he said only 5% of the murders are solved in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, the clearance rate for murder cases is like historically less than 20%. So, you know, it varies year to year. But, yes, it's very low, very low. That's, so that's one of the problems. And thanks for the call, Bob. And that's why part of the conversation is about the culture, you know, the snitches get stitches culture, for lack of a better description. And when people talk about getting engaged and...
Yeah, and if you see something, say something.
Right. And also, beyond that, it is not a mystery who's involved doing what in these neighborhoods.
Right.
You don't need to see anything.
Right.
They've seen enough.
And
they know.
Wait, wasn't it 13 or 15 gangbangers, the leaders, and they know who they are, and they know that they have a good probability of
the Chicago
shooting
the Chicago
other
police.
People.
Yeah, what Eddie Johnson said, 6, 8, 10 months ago, 1,500 people that we know in the city are likely to kill or be killed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've done ride-alongs. I did a ride-along in Canaryville with some police officers.
Did you wear a bulletproof vest?
I did. And
was it very slimming?
It did. I thought I'd look good in it.
Did you have a body camera?
I'm going to be the centerfold and tactical officer monthly.
That's right. You got
later
the centerfold
this fall.
Spread.
Yeah.
That's congratulations, Dan.
But they have the drill down on the gangs.
Yeah, they know.
They know all the gangs. They know the hierarchies. They know. They're not asleep at the switch. They have, you know, actionable intelligence.
Yeah, and those on gang detail, their days off have been suspended indefinitely.
Mike in Bolingbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hey, Dan. You know, the biggest gang is Chicago City Hall. You know,
hey.
Rahm's the gang leader. Rahm's the gang leader. Then he's got his chief of police, and he's got his little vagrants out there, Father Flager. And you know what? That's what you got to get rid of. And I do have a serious point. What's your opinion on who's got the best shot to replace this little idiot at City Hall?
You said...
Thanks for the call, Mike.
I don't want to speak for you, but Lori Lightfoot, possibly?
I think that she is... the candidate best position to beat Rahm. I think if she makes the runoff, she's the next mayor. Okay. I do. I really do.
I think Paul Vallis.
I don't. He has no constituency.
Really?
I don't see it. I don't
he's
see Vallis
come on the show. I keep calling him and texting him. I want because I'm candidate shopping.
I mean,
so I want to talk to Gary McCarthy. I want to talk to Paul Vallis. I want to talk to Lori Lightfoot.
I mean, if Vallis made the runoff. Yeah, I could, it's possible. I mean, Tiny Dancer is such a failure, such an abject failure. He's so detestable that I think there's probably a few candidates that could beat him in a runoff just because people maybe, hopefully, want to make a change. And you just have to sort of pass the kind of credibility threshold, which I think Vallis could do. So possibly, I just think Lightfoot is best positioned. It doesn't mean it's how it's going to play out. I just think.
But aren't they getting Dorothy Brown and other African Americans to run to split the African American votes?
So. Oh yeah, you know you're right.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah,
he's no fool.
Yeah, that's right.
He's maniacal and manipulative.
Dorothy Brown. By the way, speaking of,
she's been on the show before.
Oh, okay. That's fantastic. I'm sorry I wasn't here for that.
I'm sorry you weren't here for that either.
I'm actually not sorry. But speaking of law enforcement, the justice system, Dorothy Brown, how many decades has she been under federal investigation?
It's the longest federal investigation. I mean, I've gone through two marriages. She's still under federal investigation.
I mean, there's something about, there's a conversation to be had, too, when Eddie Johnson is making reference to, I've talked to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they're going to, you know, level up gun charges for federal prosecution. It's talking about the culture here. I mean,
she still gets elected.
Oh, I'm. It's so much bigger than Dorothy Brown, but talking about the political culture here, the corruption that begets these excesses, that begets this kleptocracy, and all the horrors that stem from it. When has 219 South Dearborn done something useful? with respect to the kleptocracy here, the government-directed kleptocracy, the legalized mobs, as Mike from Bolingbrook was talking about, the legalized mobsters that have offices and titles. I mean, since Blagojevich, when has something important happened? It's been a decade, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. Having a hard time putting cases together against anybody who's not some idiot alderman who takes $500 in an envelope. They're real good at those cases. The hard ones, the top of the pyramid, the top of the power structure. I don't see a lot of action. You know what I mean? Ralph in Far Texas.
Good morning, sir.
Morning.
Yeah, we may need to go back to the old police officer that walks the beat in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, where on every block he would have informants to feed him information on what is going on in that area. And that's how they were able to control crime in the, you know, 1940s and 30s. They call him the gumshoe cop, I think it was called.
Yeah, right. No, I think... Thanks for the call, Rob. I think that's a good point. That was something that was sort of initiated. I remember McCarthy doing it because it's not just about presence. It's also about trust relationship, getting to know the people that you're policing and maybe encouraging them to engage more fully. Martin,
I remember a time when they used to, police officers would come to our block parties.
Yeah.
Actually know them.
Yeah, right.
And I saw one for the first time yesterday.
No, so there is something to that.
I'm so excited.
But then they have to be empowered to, you know, defend themselves, arrest criminals. Otherwise, they're, you know, you're putting them in really in harm's way. Martin at Edison Park. Hi, Martin.
Yes, this is Martin from Edison Park.
Yep.
Hello, Amy. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
I wanted to steer back to an earlier point made by an earlier caller as far as occupying the homes. Those homes, I've been through that area, Local 134, for schools.
Okay.
And then they should raise those homes, knock them to the ground, and they have gas, sewer, water, everything there, and drop a trailer there. That would implant the police in the area, and then they would learn who and what is going on in that area by actually living their life. They wouldn't have to live in the trailer, but that would be their outpost, and then it would save money because then they wouldn't have to rehab the house.
Yeah, okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Martin.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and the implications, real-world implications of the sentimental barbarism of the left. I know this has not been in the news as much recently with respect to President Trump and sort of been subordinated to conversations about Russia and other matters. The administration on its heels with respect to the family separation policy, but border security, an issue that Republicans, again, are inclined to kick until after the midterm election. They're making a mistake. Absolutely making a mistake. Tell the stories. They're real and they're important and they're serious. And people in positions of authority, mayors and prosecutors and other elected officials, members of Congress, who don't take people's safety seriously are vulnerable and should be. City of Philadelphia, Dateline. An illegal alien from Honduras who raped a child after being released by a sanctuary city that refused to honor a detainer lodged by ICE pleaded guilty Tuesday to illegal reentry into the United States. May of 2009, deported from the U.S. In March 2014, back in the U.S., committed the rape of a minor child. Here's what the U.S. attorney in Philly said. McSwain is his name. William McSwain. Those of us in the law enforcement business should be doing everything in our power to protect vulnerable children from predators like Vasquez, the Honduran. Instead, this defendant received a free pass from the city of Philadelphia and its Department of Prisons, headed straight back into our community, committed a heinous crime he would never have had the chance to commit if the city of Philadelphia complied with the ICE detainer. In the sanctuary state of Illinois, we're discussing this. Advanced by Republicans, Republican governor. Miami. An illegal alien from Honduras recently arrested, charged with the murder of two women. He confessed to both murders, did Juan Carlos Hernandez Caceres, 37 years old, kill two prostitutes. Oy. ICE spokesman Nestor Iglesias said that Hernandez Caceres was an illegally present Honduran national that ICE had placed an immigration detainer on. Arkansas. A Mexican national living in Northwest Arkansas was recently arrested and charged with raping an 11-year-old girl. A related story, in California, Border Patrol agents arrested a different Mexican national who had been deported multiple times and convicted of unlawful sexual relations with a minor under the age of 14. Excuse me. Deputies confirmed that the Mexican national in Northwest Arkansas illegally was living in Northwest Arkansas illegally. The Mexican national in California illegally crossed into the border for the second time this year, the one with the criminal record that included the statutory rape as well as peddling drugs.
And then we have Taos, New Mexico, where this compound was allowed to form somehow. Three, what police call radicalized Muslims, two men, three women, had 11 children in this compound, and apparently they were training them for school shootings.
There was a shooting range built on the west side of the property.
And when police arrived, they found a number of rifles, semi-automatic weapons, just a stash, a cache, I should say, of weapons and ammo. And the children told police that, yes, we did target practice to train for mass shootings.
They're Islamists.
They're Islamists.
Yeah.
They're Islamists.
Yeah.
Right.
The principal who was arrested is the son of a prominent Brooklyn-based imam.
Oh. And the reason why the police were drawn to that compound is because they were following a three-year-old boy who was reported missing from Georgia in December, and the dad is in charge of that compound.
So we talked about the advance of the 2016 election, that in part it was going to be a law and order election, because of Trump's opposition to sanctuary cities and sanctuary states and sanctuary policies, because of the unwillingness of the left to confront the threat of Islamofascism. Maybe 2018 should be at least in part a law and order election as well. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Zudi Jassers, the president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement, a former United States Navy lieutenant commander, and author of the book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam. Dr. Jassers, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
What about the story that Amy was recounting about this compound in New Mexico? This guy, the principal who was training these children to be killers, his father is also a cleric with apparently close ties to groups like the Islamic Circle of North America, the Muslim American Society's CARE, and was an unindicted co-conspirator in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing.
Well, I'm so glad you're covering this, and I can't believe the regular media is not covering this more.
No, not at all.
Again, and it's amazing. His father, Siraj Wahaj, and the person who was found at this compound, the father who is the imam, the grandfather, his son Siraj Wahaj Jr., is the one who was sort of leading the separatist horrific treatment of these children. It turns out they're being trained for shooting and perhaps committing acts of terror in schools and things like that. And you know, listen, no one's saying that the imam from New York, Siraj Wahaj Sr., necessarily planned or was connected. But what we're missing in my book, as you mentioned, A Battle for the Soul of Islam, there's three pages from page 84 to to page 88, in which I talk about an imam. When I went to the only meeting of the Islamic Society of North America that I ever went to, I got there and I saw at the keynote address was this Siraj Wahaj Sr. He holds up the Quran and says that it is our goal as American Muslims to change the Constitution from this man-made faulty document that makes this country into a secular hedonistic country to make it into a religious state, an Islamic state, and replace this Constitution with a God-given document, the Quran. I then was horrified. They had an opportunity for people to go to the microphone. I went to the microphone. I said, I don't know what if you guys understand what sedition is, but what you just witnessed from Mr. Siraj Wahaj was an act of sedition. You're free to disagree with American politics and policy, but not to talk about wholesale change of the Constitution. And that was in 95 in front of 15,000 people. ISMA is the largest Muslim organization in America. A lot of the mosques across the country participate. Their deeds are controlled by that organization. And yet, 25 years later, he's still involved in boards of advisors. He still speaks regularly. Linda Sarsour identified him at a large gathering in Washington as her primary mentor and asked him to stand up. So he is a mainstream activist. And to say that his separatism was not a gateway drug for the radicalization of his son is just absurd. And it's a story that nobody's covering. We talk about so many pathways when we talk about guns and other things because it's politically correct for the left to do that. And yet when you talk about Muslim radicalization from someone who is beyond mainstream, this is a leading fundraiser for the Muslim community in many organizations. And all he does is posted in Facebook in January that my son has disappeared. I don't know where he is. Please find him. And now he's saying, oh, thank God he's been found, et cetera. And yet it's like the alcoholic father who's wondering why his kid is strung out on heroin and cocaine and he can't figure it out.
I mean, we had those 13 kids tied up and you know, deprived food, and everybody knows about that story. And then this, there's 11 children. We don't know their ages, but they were malnourished. Some were very ill. They were living in squalor, just horrific conditions, if you know, watch the reports. But no one is talking about this. But the bigger question, do you think there might be other compounds like this in the U.S.?
There have been discussed. This is a known story, which is Jamaat al-Fukra, and it's called the Muslims of America compounds that the Clarion Project and Ryan Morrow has talked about frequently. And when he does, he's called an Islamophobe, and these are just sort of wacky groups. And yet, even with that, they have had connections to political candidates and other things. So this compound seems to be in that same type of scenario, and there may. Those Jamaat al-Fukra compounds, by the way, are run by an imam from Pakistan by the name of Imam Jalani. There's some connections, I believe, with this compound in New Mexico and those compounds. So we're still trying to get all the facts on them, but this is not a unique story. Now, again, most of the Muslim community, even the Islamist groups that are nonviolent, don't live in such a deep separatist way. However, there is a connection. There is. It's sort of like saying, well, the Communist Party in America in the Cold War had nothing to do with the Soviets. To say that there was no connection between those ideologues and that folks that were working against this country traversed between both systems of ideas would have been foolhardy on our part.
Well, right. And this data point may be a bit dated, but you mentioned the Clarion Project, and I remember their report maybe a year or so ago, where of the few thousand mosques in the country, they had identified five or six dozen that were radicalized or the leadership was radicalized, that they were a concern, that they should sort of be monitored, not necessarily by the surveillance state, but, you know, they should be tagged and, you know, watch what these guys are doing at these particular mosques. Now, that's a small fraction of the several thousand mosques in the country. So it represents a small fraction of the Muslim population. But I just don't understand why we can't have a sensible conversation about obvious red flags and, you know, have the response be proportional. I'm not talking about the Muslims in America. I'm talking about these specific entities, organizations, and leaders.
And, you know, listen, if you're going to protect our country, you don't just do a whack-a-mole program and deal with the violent terrorists when they come up, and sometimes we miss them and sometimes we're lucky and our agents find them hours, if not a few days, before they commit the act. But if it's the Boston bombers that were connected to the large mosque, connected to the Brotherhood and Imam Qardawi out of Qatar, or if it's Imam Awlaki, who, by the way, was radicalized himself through the Muslim Student Association and then went to some mosques, and he himself became a radicalizer and became an enemy of this country. So this common pathway, how many times do we need to see it before we start to have a conversation and to say, and I testified to the U.S. Congress just 3 weeks ago to Chairman DeSantis about why the Muslim Brotherhood should be declared a foreign terrorist organization. And look at the Holy Land Foundation trial in 2007. We were able to shut down a charity, not calling it a terror group, but saying, you know what, it was funding a terror group of Hamas. Because Hamas is labeled a terror group, we were able to shut down a significant stream of financing that was radicalizing Muslims here. And yet our country, founded on fighting theocracy, can't seem to articulate that Muslim theocrats are our enemy and Muslims who are secular and anti-theocratic are our friends and our allies. It's just beyond bizarre.
Which one is, which category does this soon-to-be first Muslim-American female congresswoman from Michigan, who won the Democrat primary on Tuesday, which category does she fit in? Is she another Keith Ellison?
She is another Keith Ellison there. It is a sad day in America that she's now the Democratic Party nominee, and not one question has been asked of her of her position on Islamic State concepts of foreign policy and working with governments like when the Muslim Brotherhood is running Egypt. What is her position on working with CARE? She has just a few months ago identified Islamic Relief as an she stood next to the head of Islamic Relief and said, this is where, in talking about Flint and other things, saying this is where money should go to help water not only in America and in Flint, Michigan, but in Gaza and elsewhere. So the Islamic Relief, the Muslim, Middle East Forum has a huge report about their connections to Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, and other radical groups. So the one good point about Ms. Tlaib becoming the candidate is for 50 years, Conyers owned that seat, was never challenged. Mm-hmm. And he was a shill for the Islamists in the Detroit area. And nobody challenged him because he said he was doing it under the cover of being pro-Muslim. Well, now at least it's no longer a cover. We have a Muslim there who is probably an Islamist. She hasn't been vetted ideologically, but at least it's no longer going to be sort of a shill. It's going to be an actual Islamist in the seat, and it won't be deceptive.
I wanted to go to the kind of the global stage for a minute and just get your take as the Trump administration seems to be in the process of engaging the Taliban for some sort of deal to provide, I think, political cover to withdraw the 15,000 troops that remain. 17 years in, the prospect of the Taliban reasserting control of Afghanistan, what are the implications if that's what comes to pass in terms of the larger war against Islamic theocrats?
Well, you know, this has been one of the key issues that I've been concerned about is unless we have a global strategy, a doctrine in which we say Islamism is the problem, moderate secular Muslims are the solution, we're going to continue to be confused when our military, especially on the ground, end up working with folks that don't want war but just want some peace. So this is where the conflict happens is, you know, listen, I was in the Navy, and I get it. I served in Somalia. We worked with some pretty bad folks there trying to avoid military conflict between the tribes in the region. It's not like we were pro-tribal warlords, but we just didn't want them to kill each other, and it was better for them not to fight. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, I get it when our military in Afghanistan says, and we shouldn't use the word moderate Taliban, there is no such a thing, that's an oxymoron, but there may be some on the ground that don't want to fight and simply want to create a peaceful coexistence, if you will, whatever that is. The problem is we've not had a strategy with the Afghanistan government to clean out the area, to have an ideological approach, which is counter-Islamist. Their neighbors, Pakistan, just elected a cricket player who went through a transformation, even though he claims to be secular. Imran Khan went from being a playboy, secular man married to a Jewish lady to, in this last campaign, married to a woman who covers from head to foot, wears a niqab, and basically towed the Islamist line. So in Pakistan, we see at the end of the day, the Jamaat Islamiyah, the radical Islamists, even though they don't, you know, have a candidate that won, still controls electoral politics. Same thing to their neighbor, Afghanistan. The Taliban has a huge influence on electoral politics. And unless we help revolutionaries like we're doing in Iran, you are not going to see significant change.
He is Dr. Zudi Jasser, medical doctor, as he mentioned, served our country in the U.S. Navy as a lieutenant commander, president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, the book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam. Dr. Jasser, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, this is good news. Sunlight truly is the best disinfectant.
What is the best disinfectant?
Sunlight.
Oh, sunlight.
Yeah, for Justice Brandeis. This Elizabeth Heng, she's the Cambodian American.
Who hates old white men.
No, that's Sarah Jeong.
Oh, so.
Elizabeth Heng is the Cambodian American. Exactly. If you could just quell your racism for just a moment.
Amy, could you put your racism on the back burner for a second? I'm trying to get through a story.
Difficult
here.
For me to talk about Elizabeth Heng, the Cambodian American Republican candidate for Congress, who Facebook.
Oh, that's right.
Facebook refused her ad telling her story of her family escaping the genocide at the hands of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, the communists. So Facebook's hate speech apology was no to anti-communism, but yes to anti-Semitism because they leave Farrakhan stuff up.
Oh.
Well, after that story got a little bit of attention, Facebook reversed its block on Elizabeth Heng's introductory video about her personal story, her family story, and it's now up.
And I actually watched it in its entirety. Do they even watch these things before they yank them?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
it was so ridiculous.
Algorithms and liberal toadies of Zuckerberg, and that's what you get.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And so the back and forth between Robert Mueller's investigative operation and President Trump's legal team continues. Yesterday, the news that Trump's lawyers rejected the latest terms presented by Bob Mueller for an interview with President Trump pertaining to the Russia investigation, countering with an offer that suggested a much more narrow path for answering questions, the New York Times reported. Jay Sekulow, one of Trump's personal lawyers, confirmed a response was sent to Mueller, but declined to comment on its content. Giuliani, of course, saying what he's been saying for a while, which is it's time to wrap this thing up. Now, it's interesting, of course, the back and forth part of this discussion and debate over the many months has been, well, why doesn't Mueller just subpoena President Trump? He has subpoena power, and then they could fight out whether or not to comply with the subpoena. I thought Saul Weisenberg, who was on with Laura Ingraham's show the other night, former federal prosecutor, Whitewater counsel, made a really good point about why he is resistant to do that. Mueller resistant to issue that subpoena.
Well, no prosecutor worth his salt is going to accept those kind of preconditions. But there is a reason, and I do agree with and have long agreed with Professor Dershowitz's assertion that the president shouldn't go in and answer these questions is far too dangerous. But there's a reason Bob Mueller has put up with this dance for so long, and I think a lot of people don't understand it. If he issues a subpoena to force President Trump to be interviewed by him, to go to the grand jury, for example, certainly President Trump has to accept that subpoena. You can subpoena a president, but then when President Trump invokes executive privilege, under the law, the current law in the D.C. Circuit in resealed case, it is going to be very difficult and time-consuming for Bob Mueller to ask the questions he wants to ask, particularly about obstruction, and there is absolutely no guarantee that he will win. You're talking about the heart of executive privilege here, presidential communications and presidential thought processes, and Mueller would have to show that it's very, very important evidence and that he can't get it anywhere else. And don't forget, When Jaworski won the tapes case against Nixon, and when Cox won the earlier case, they knew their subpoenas were incredibly narrowly drawn. They knew the tapes existed. They knew there were potentially incriminatory conversations on those tapes. Mueller does not have that.
Mueller doesn't have it, exactly. Right. So Mueller's engaged in a fishing expedition trying to come up with the case, whereas Watergate prosecutors, since this is that's a comparison made so often, knew they had a case.
Right, and they had evidence. And Rudy Giuliani, he's getting a little upset.
Stop the nonsense. You are trying to trap him into perjury because you don't have a case.
And I don't know if President Trump, I mean, he has probably taken more depositions than your average businessman. But he, I don't think he has the self-control. I would never want him to be face-to-face with Robert Mueller. Because I don't trust Robert Mueller. And Lord knows, I mean, I know they were supposed to have an outline of the questions that will be asked, but you never know.
But, of course, the political position for public consumption, the president wants to be seen as having no fear, being willing to sit down, which is why they haven't ruled out, his legal team has not ruled out an interview with Mueller. They just continue to kind of go back and forth over the terms. And in particular, in the latest Perry and Repost was over obstruction of justice.
Right. And it says Mueller said to be contemplating reducing the number of questions he planned to ask Trump about his obstruction of justice during the sit down.
I mean, we continue sort of batting around the same questions because the same issues at bar. So 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Should President Trump and his legal team find a way to make an interview with Mueller work if Mueller is willing to accede to their restrictions, even though, as you heard from a former federal prosecutor, Saul Weisenberg, no prosecutor worth the salt would normally accept the terms and conditions that are being demanded by Trump's legal team. But of course, this isn't a normal investigation. You're talking about the president of the United States. So has your opinion changed at all over the intervening many months that we've been asking and discussing this question of should the president subject himself to an interview, narrowly tailored interview with Mueller for the purposes of transparency, clearing the air, concluding the investigation.
Yeah, and the New York Times also says that Mueller would allow Trump to submit some of his responses on that topic in writing.
And another call that we've heard from other quarters before comes from Michael Goodwin, the New York Post this week, who's basically a supporter of Trump's. It's an op-ed writer. He goes through Rod Rosenstein's sins of giving spawn to Mueller and stiff-arming Congress to disclose information requested by from the Department of Justice and his lack of interest in handling the Clinton email investigation, in investigating how that email investigation was handled, I should say. He suggests Trump has the ace in the hole, which is to declassify documents related to these investigations, both how the Clinton email investigation was handled and the Russian matters of Russian collusion, allegations of Russian collusion. Have the Justice Department give Congress everything it wants, subject to very limited restrictions. He has that power. Do it. Throw open the doors, Mr. President, and turn history's page toward openness. Today would be a great day to start, writes Goodwin. So, again, declassifying documents that have been requested by members of Congress and frustrated by Department of Justice, that's something else the president could do. And many, myself included, have argued he should.
And either way, Rudy Giuliani wants this to be done in the next 3 weeks.
We do not want to run into the November elections. So back up from that, this should be over with by September 1st. We have now given him an answer. Obviously, he should take a few days to consider it. But we should get this resolved.
All right. Take your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, Bruce in Bloomingdale.
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
Morning.
You know, if we had an attorney general, he would have put an end to this farce 6 months ago. He would have ordered his department to comply completely and fully with every congressional request and subpoena. But since we don't have an attorney general until somebody winds him up and he goes out and talks about pot smokers, we're stuck with this situation, which is probably the most open act of sedition in this country's history.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bruce. So wait, Bruce. So, should Trump
do a sit-down interview with Robert Mueller?
Should they try to get to a yes from Mueller, or should he just walk away? Should just go on with this
walk on by
pantomime, as it were.
I wouldn't do it in a million years.
Okay. Dan in Libertyville.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. On Hannity last night, there was a bombshell that was dropped that should close this whole investigation and actually put all of the participants under arrest. Bruce Orr has been revealed to have been trying to get Steele rehired for the FBI after it was exposed that half of the things he said were lies and that he was working for Hillary and it was all a sham. And he filtered information to Mueller when Mueller's investigation first started. So the whole investigation is tainted. It's corrupt. They know it. Fact of the matter is people should be in cuffs right now, and the Mueller investigation should be history.
Thanks for the call, Daniel. We talked about that on Monday per Byron York's good reporting in the Washington Examiner over the weekend about Bruce Orr being the cutout for Christopher Steele to communicate to the FBI after his contractual relationship was terminated, and there were specific dates in which information was provided. Bruce Orr, whose wife, of course, was employed by Fusion GPS, that hired Christopher Steele to do the Trump dossier. So you're right, it is tainted. This is terribly problematic. Bruce Orr's position at Justice and time at Justice is terribly troubling. And more information continues to leak out, you know. It's not really a leak, but I mean, just kind of come out in bits and pieces. Christopher Steele expressed concern last year to Senate committee's request for information about the Trump dossier, according to text messages provided to Congress. Would it be possible to speak today, later today, please? We're very concerned by the Grassley letter, Senator Chuck Grassley, and its possible implications for us, our operations, our sources. We need some reassurance, Steele wrote in a text message to Bruce Orr. In March of 2017, Bruce Orr was still the Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the time. Yeah. Problematic indeed. Just as an aside, I thought Jonathan Turley, who's a law professor at George Washington, you see him on the cable shows and whatnot, is a legal analyst. He had a good piece in The Hill about the Trump Tower meeting, which, of course, has also been kicked around over the last weekend into this week, trying to kind of resuscitate the importance of that. If the Trump Tower meeting is illegal, then so is the Clinton dossier. I mean, the Trump Tower meeting may have been stupid and amateurish the way that it was assembled.
Right.
You know, these like some Eastern European pop star setting up a meeting with. It's bizarre.
It's so goofy.
It is goofy. And there's a lot of goofy people around Trump, and some may be in his family. But in terms of the op research, foreign sources, Turley makes an excellent point. If you want to criminalize the Trump Tower meeting, then what say you about the foreign sources used by the Clinton campaign and the FBI, for that matter, to cobble together the Trump dossier?
On an ancillary issue, over the weekend, I don't know if you heard this, but President Trump was talking about Jared Kushner. And he said, my Ivanka could have married Tom Brady. Instead, she married Jared Kushner.
I can understand his disappointment.
Ouch. I mean,
Mike in Crown Point, Indiana, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Isn't there an amendment that says you're not supposed to be able to testify against yourself?
Well, you have the right against self-incrimination. Yes, that would be the proverbial right. Taking the fifth.
So what's the point of questioning somebody about their alleged criminal activity? The other thing is I still understand why the ACLU or somebody isn't up in arms about these guys breaking into Trump's personal attorney office and grabbing all this stuff. I'm not a lawyer, I'm an engineer, but geez, I've never heard of that in any case in the United States where you went barge into somebody's lawyer, violated a client attorney privilege to get information. That's sick.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. The ACLU, very much like the NAACP, their principles do not extend to persons with whom they disagree politically. So, as Alan Dershowitz has found out. Kevin in Northfield.
Hey, guys. You're doing great. 1789, right before the French Revolution, there were two separate courts, depending on if you were a commoner or if you were a member of the aristocracy, the monarchy, friends of friends of Bill, that kind of thing. Two separate courts, two different meetings out of justice, depending on who you were. Why doesn't Trump demand the treatment that Hillary got? When the FBI sat down to interview her, they thought they were sitting down with the next president. There was no swearing in. There was no transcription even. There was no recording. It wasn't on videotape.
And it wasn't under oath.
All kinds of people who were pretend lawyers were her lawyers in attendance. Why doesn't Trump demand the same treatment that Hillary got by the FBI? I wonder.
Thanks for the call, Kevin.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, this would be a one-off that you just kind of quickly dismiss if it weren't Chicago. But one of the 12 individuals murdered over the weekend.
And then what? Is it 12 or 13? I mean, it's like they can't even keep count.
Well,
I've heard so many different numbers.
You have 70 people injured, so maybe some of them don't make it. I mean, it's a sort of a rolling number.
Yeah, that's so sad.
I mean, I hate to talk about human life like that, but. Those are the statistics. But a gentleman profiled by CBS, the local CBS affiliate, told his story, Stories of the Dead in Chicago, unfortunately a recurring segment. Earl Young is his name, lived in South Shore neighborhood.
Young was murdered Friday, one of 12 killed over the violent weekend. Payne says it all stemmed from Young's two puppies on the porch of his South Shore home.
And the puppies were peeing on the porch. And the pee ran down the porch into the neighbors.
Police say Young and the neighbor below exchanged words. Then Young was shot and killed. He was 30.
How petty are we now that we're living in a world that you could lose your life over puppy pee?
I don't know. How petty are we? To answer that question, or help us answer that question, we're pleased to be joined by State Representative LaShawn Ford, who is a legislator from the west side of the city. LaShawn, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan and Amy.
So you represent neighborhoods that have to deal with this endemic street crime violence. What should we be doing that we're not doing?
Well, it's important to say not only when you represent a community, you live in the community.
Yeah.
And your family and friends all live in the community. And I think that it's a must that we really respectfully look at the problem as an epidemic, like you said, in a state of emergency. Look at it as if there was a massive flood and there's, you know, the state of emergency where we're going to send in resources to help the communities where there was a flood. So there's been lots of killings, lots of violence, which means that it will continue if we don't try to help heal some of the people with behavioral health. The communities are filled with trauma, and so hurt people continue to hurt one another. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is to make sure that we work closely with the Chicago Public Schools and the State Board of Education to make sure that we have quality schools on the west side and south side of Chicago. It's clear, if we take one community, let's just say we take Lincoln Park community, and we say, this is a good model. Let's put that model in Austin and see how it turns out.
But what's
and
the model?
And when I say that model,
that
model is schools.
Yeah. So this has to do with Chicago public schools. So if we had a stronger school system, these shootings wouldn't be happening in Boston and Inglewood and South Shore?
Absolutely not, because the Chicago public schools sort of, for lack of a better term, breed the people that we have on the streets. So if you're not graduating, and the dropout rate is very high because the schools are not adequate in those areas, and the Chicago public schools will tell you, our schools are great in Lincoln Park. Our schools are great in, what is it? I think we have Whitney Young, Lane Tech. We know the great schools, but what about the other ones?
I want to talk about schools, but there's something that predates K through 12 education, and that's the family. Is there a discussion to be had community-wide that basically says, take care of your household?
Of course.
Take care of your household, and if you need help, raise your hand, because there's a lot of people who want to help. But you're responsible for what happens in your household and what that produces in the community, and you need to take ownership of it.
Absolutely. Everyone should be responsible if they have children, to take care of their children. And there should be no excuse for people that are negligent in that. But we also have to make sure that we are aware and not forget, if we really want to help the communities of the criminal justice system. You know, I was indicted on 17 counts of bank fraud. Mm-hmm. And had I been convicted of 17 counts of bank fraud and served time and came out, I probably would have never been able to get a job. I have my degree in education. I have a real estate license, an insurance license. I had these things, and I had a political career. Had I been convicted on a case that was ultimately thrown out on the day of trial, and I give a great respect to my attorney, Durkin, Thomas Durkin, for believing and fighting the system. So I say that to say that there are a lot of people that, one, have been convicted of crimes that they never did, and they're living in those communities, and they have felonies. We have people that have convicted crimes, but they're reformed, and they have felonies. Now, all of these people, most of them return to Austin, Inglewood, and they can't find jobs because people will not hire them. Mm-hmm. So what are they to do? Now, I don't say you go out and commit crimes, but I'm saying the government must find ways to, if we truly want to help these communities, we have to make sure people are employable and put them to work.
I'm all for discussions of helping ex-offenders that are to assimilate back in society. Some of these individuals are going to come out of prison, and so we can't pretend that that's not an issue. It is an issue. But when you talk about the criminal justice system, what about the other side? I mentioned this the other day on the show, but I'll mention it to you. A friend of mine is a criminal defense attorney, works at 26th and Cal, told me they have not charged their 10,000th felony yet at the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Normally that happens about April of every year, and they're a couple thousand short of that, and now we sit in August. Point being, the job that Kim Fox is doing as Cook County State's Attorney to put away repeat and repeat violent offenders, repeat instances of gun-related crimes. How would you assess the job that she's doing? Because a lot of what we hear and what I hear from people inside the state's attorney's office, people in the system, is that Kim Fox is basically a walking get-out-of-jail-free card.
Well, I would say that if we're 10,000, if we haven't hit 10,000, we have to think about most of the people that were getting felonies were petty drug cases, and they were not violent offenders. And therefore, we should not be slapping felonies, life sentences on people if they are not a threat to society. And I am all for locking up dangerous people, people that are a menace to society. If they're in my family, if they're my friends, if they're my loved ones, it doesn't matter to me. If they need to be behind bars, they need to be behind bars, because there's nothing we can do with them if they don't want the help. But there are people that have been charged with felonies in the past for simple drug cases, and their lives are ruined. It's a life sentence.
Now, Governor Rauner has weighed in on calling in the Illinois National Guard. He said no, because it's not a riot situation. And what are your thoughts on that? Because I know, I think it was, what, about 5 years ago, you
teamed
up with another politician to try and urge the governor then to, you know, let the Illinois National Guard help out.
One thing about being a representative is you have to listen to your constituents and you have to make sure that you represent them the way they would like and ways that will make the community better. So the call for the National Guard at the time was not taken well by the constituents. And, you know, they respectfully met over and over. They don't want the National Guards. That means I don't want the National Guards. I've learned since then that that's not the approach to bring in the National Guard.
Do they want several hundred more police officers that are scheduled to be deployed on the west and south sides starting right now? Yeah.
You know, it's I think that people are in fear because as I noted some time ago that Chicago is more violent than the days of Al Capone. So people are in fear, but we have to make sure the officers that's coming into our communities are trained. And what we have to do is not use our police officers as enemies of the community, but they should be finding out how to cut the flow of illegal drugs and illegal guns in these communities, protect our borders. And that's one of the reasons why I thought that the intelligence of the federal government with Donald Trump would be great. We need to bring in the United States intelligence to help us eliminate these illegal drugs and guns in our communities.
Protect our
borders.
So you don't see the police obviously as an enemy of the community. You've just indicated it. I mean, there's some stipulations, but okay. What about the consent decree that the Tribune is urging the city to ratify? Has such pressing reforms as making sure Chicago police officers ask individuals their preferred gender pronoun.
Well, you know, I can't respond to that. And I know you are a host and a reporter and you want answers, but I just have not gotten to that yet. But what I can tell you is that we are going to have a community form on the consent decree with Lisa Madigan's office in my area where I live and represent. So that's being set up with Lisa Madigan's office right now so that we can understand what the consent decree is saying and how the community could help make our Chicago police force better. I think when I see Chicago police, I say they're human. And my mother always tells me, you know, these people have to respect the law enforcement because they want to go home, too.
Right.
And so I come from a family that respects law enforcement and is a constant reminder that we have to all get along. So what we have to do is we have to have an olive branch from the Chicago police and the community to say that we want to be better. I want to be better. The police department want to be better. And they have to show it. And we have to show it. But when you have stings set up like they set up on the south side with gym shoes or whatever in the 18-wheeler, that is not an olive branch when you set people up to fail.
I just want to go back to close the circle on the issue you brought up before about CPS schools on the west side being like the CPS schools in Lincoln Park. What do you think the problem is at CPS, and I mean, in addition to sexual abuse that goes unreported and mishandled, but in terms of having the kind of schools that exist in the other parts of the city, because the per pupil spend is similar, if not more, than suburban schools, say, for example. So what's the hurdle that needs to be cleared so that West Side schools are like those in Lincoln Park or the North Side?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thanks for asking that. So in Austin, we have a failed public school system, whereas we need a new traditional public high school in the Austin community. What WBEZ did a report, and they did a report stating that the Austin schools didn't have books. They did not have teachers to teach the children, and the children were interviewed. When they were interviewed, they said, we're not going to be prepared to take the ACT because we haven't had teachers, we don't have books, we don't have foreign language. I mean,
where's the money going? Where's the money going?
Right, where's the money going? But guess what? It's not the individual schools, it's CPS. CPS controls the budget at $7-something billion, and it's unchecked. It's Rahm Emanuel's ability to run the schools and put the money where he wants it. And so I think that when you talk about families and their responsibilities, I think it's families and their responsibilities to fight and want more, want better education for their children. That's a big, that's our role as citizens in this state, to ask for and demand better for our families.
All right. He is State Representative LaShawn Ford, a Democrat from the west side of the city. LaShawn, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan and Amy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
White Sox! White Sox! Go, go, White Sox! Let's go, 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 White Sox!
Only 21 games or 22 games out of first place, make a late season run.
Yeah, no big deal. Uh-huh. But we have another reason for you to love the Chicago White Sox. Remember that grounds crew member? His name is Nevis Coleman. He was a member of the groundskeeping crew for years. And in 1994, he was wrongly convicted of rape and murdering a 20-year-old Inglewood woman.
Mm-hmm.
Spent 23 years in jail before he was exonerated and released. And the White Sox opened him back. Welcomed him back with open arms.
There's no more anger, upset, frustrated, nothing. Because, you know, when I was in there, I was miserable. But now I got my loved ones behind me and standing on my side. That misery gone now.
And it was really great. I mean, before this, you know, wrongful conviction, he never missed a day of work. He was a loyal employee. That's one of the reasons they brought him back. And yesterday, I don't know why this makes me cry, they gave him a World Series watch because they said that he would have been with the team during the 2005 World Series. Jerry Reinsdorf gathered the crew yesterday and made an announcement and gave him the watch.
Nevis, you should have been with us in 2005 when we won the World Series, but you were someplace else. Had you been here, there's something that you would have gotten as a member of the grounds crew. So I want to give you that something right now. We don't want you to be cheated.
That's where you said something you should have had, so now you have it.
Absolutely. A classy move by the White Sox organization. It's the appropriate thing to do, and hopefully Nevis will be around for a couple of more of those World Series championship watches in the not-too-distant future.
And he's patient, too, like most White Sox fans.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, best-selling author and documentarian. Dinesh D'Souza is out with a new film, Death of a Nation. It's coming to a theater near you. I think it's already showing at River East in my neighborhood.
Yep.
So I have to check that out. Always enjoyed Dinesh D'Souza's work back to his first book. I don't know. It's got to be 25 years ago. Illiberal Education. Death of a Nation asks the question, can we save America a second time? And if you've seen the trailer or some of the marketing, it's got like a half a face Lincoln, half a face Trump.
So yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's the hearkening back to the Civil War. For perhaps some insight into the answer to that question, we're pleased to be joined by the filmmaker himself, Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's a great pleasure. Good to be on the show.
So can we save America a second time? Explain why you frame the Trump presidency in the context of the Civil War and Lincoln's ascension?
Well, I do that because a lot of people compare the Trump era now to the Reagan era, and they, you know, wistfully pine for getting the Reagan era of gentleman's politics back. But alas, we don't live in that era anymore. The waters are really roiled politically. Let's remember that with Trump, you have a Republican president, an outsider, who won unexpectedly, and in a sense, all hell has broken loose ever since. The Democrats simply can't accept the result of the election, and so all kinds of craziness, Trump is a racist, Trump is a fascist, all these charges flying around to delegitimize Trump and the conservatives. Now, the last time this happened was in 1860. A Republican president, Lincoln, won narrowly and unexpectedly. Once again, all hell broke loose. Once again, the rival party, happened to be the same party, the Democrats, said, we won't accept this. The Northern Democrats, some of them called for Lincoln to be assassinated. The Southern Democrats decided to break up the country. So Lincoln, I think if he lived today, would understand these roiled political waters, because the political waters were even more roiled in his time.
But
that's
it,
why this is an appropriate analogy.
But the underlying issue of slavery, what is that comparable to today?
Well, here's where, this is actually even more interesting, because Lincoln defined slavery as you work and I eat. In other words, Lincoln said slavery is a kind of theft. One guy does the work, another guy steals his labor. And Lincoln said that this is the credo, not just of the South, but of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party stands for theft. And he said the Republican Party stands for the opposite. You know, so in Lincoln's words, the hand that makes the corn has the right to eat the corn. So for Lincoln, the Republican Party is you get to keep the fruits of what you make. Now, what's incredible is that although a lot of people on the left today say, oh, the party switched sides, oh, Lincoln would be a progressive today, in reality, you can see that this great Lincolnite distinction between the two parties is completely valid today. Even now, the Democrats stand for you work, I eat. And even now, the Republicans stand for the hand that makes the corn has the right to eat the corn. So I'm not claiming that slavery is going on today in the old sense. But I am claiming that the Democrats still kind of run these ethnic plantations. They got black ghettos, Latino barrios, Native American reservations, and life on those places is actually terrible. And yet the Democratic Party keeps maintaining them in a kind of subdued subjugation. So I think Lincoln would recognize that even though times have changed, Lincoln, with his insight, would be able to see there's a continuity between the old Democratic Party and the Democratic Party today.
And you proposed the premise, if you think Trump is a white supremacist, you should talk to a real one. And in the film, you interviewed Richard Spencer. What was that like?
I mean, this interview with Spencer is worth going to the movie alone for, because it's mind-blowing. Ever since the Charlottesville rally of last year, and by the way, it's coming back this weekend, the media has portrayed these white nationalists as right-wingers. They're on the right. Gee, look over there. You got a white supremacist in a Trump hat. And so what I do in the book, Death of a Nation, I look at all the leading white supremacists, one after the other, and I show that all of them are deeply anchored in the left, including the main organizer of the Charlottesville rally, Jason Kessler, who was an Obama activist. So think about this. How does an Obama activist become a white supremacist? It makes no sense. But there was no effort to look at this, to dig into it. In the movie, I look at Richard Spencer, who's the most famous white nationalist in America. It becomes stunningly clear to the audience in a very few minutes that far from being on the right, this guy is firmly on the left. He's a progressive. It comes out of his own mouth. I'm a progressive, end quote. And Spencer talks about the fact that his favorite presidents are all Democrats. He doesn't like Reagan. He thinks our rights don't come from God. They come from the state. He wants nationalized health care. So on and on it goes. And I think what really dawns on the audience is not just that this guy's a left winger, but that the media, the left wing media, has sold them a bill of goods. They have spun a narrative about Charlottesville that's basically a big lie. And exposing that lie, I think, is very liberating, because you begin to realize that that the truth is a powerful political weapon indeed.
Well, and so the Democrat socialists of the day, I mean, in terms of where this is going to go one direction or the other in terms of can we save America a second time, the underlying question your film sets forth. Is that the big fight, the Democrat socialists that have taken over the Democratic Party versus people who believe in free minds and free markets?
Right. I mean, remember that the old Nazis were socialists. That was the name of their party, the National Socialist Party. One reason Hitler fought with the communists wasn't because he disagreed with them about socialism. The basic problem was he thought that they were traitors to Germany who were loyal to Moscow. So they were international communists. They were international socialists, and Hitler was a national socialist. Well, if you look at people like this young woman, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, she's a national socialist. I mean, she doesn't want to redistribute America's wealth to Haiti or to India. She wants to redistribute within America. That means she's not an international socialist. She's obviously a national socialist.
And how much does immigration, illegal immigration, play into this? We see it going on in Chicago right now, where you have the mayor here can't win re-election with the existing population, so he needs to import new voters to try and win that way. And
we have that new city ID card that you can use
to register to vote. Right. So, how much is this this part of the battle line?
Well, it's an important battle line because, really, I don't think in my lifetime, and I have to think back historically, I don't believe there's a major party that has ever openly advocated lawlessness in this way. I mean, I realize the Democrats would like to have dead people voting, illegals voting, and so on, change the demographic composition of America. But nevertheless, you'd think they'd go about that by proposing changes in the immigration law, trying to get new legislation passed. But the very idea of becoming the party of illegals and essentially, see, to me, I mean, I'm a non-white legal immigrant. And I think that illegal immigration is an insult, not just to native-born Americans, but also to legal immigrants. I have lots of people in India who'd love to come to America. Mm-hmm. They can't swim across the river or jump across the fence. They got to stand in a very long line. So the illegal immigrant basically saying, I get to cut the line. And the Democratic Party says, you know, we're going to help you do that.
And with respect to the kind of who's going to save America the second time, if you will, just on this issue, you see Republicans and even President Trump being kind of open to the idea of kicking the immigration issue, the border security issue, past the midterm elections. Don't really want to tackle it. Certainly they don't on the Hill. So how sanguine are you about Republicans and perhaps Republicans under President Trump doing the things that are necessary to turn back the National Socialists?
Well, I think Lincoln understood from the beginning that the way that you save America is you shut down the Democratic plantation. And in 1865, the Democratic actual plantation, the old slave plantation, was shut down. But the plantation mentality has continues to this day. And so I think really going after that, this whole notion of ethnic dependency, of exchanging your vote for a meager provision provided by the Democratic Party. Now, Trump is kind of already on it. But the Republican Party, I think, is not on it. And that is the need to basically really go after the black vote, the Latino vote, the Asian American vote. Because if Republicans can get 25% of the black vote, 40% of the Asian American vote, of the Latino vote, the Democratic Party would essentially be finished. But Republicans need to take their case for ladders of opportunity directly into the inner cities and into the barrios, and contrast that with the ropes of dependency that the Democrats are letting down from the top of a very tall building.
He is Dinesh D'Souza, author of Death of a Nation, many best-selling books, Death of a Nation, The Big Lie, many others you should check out. Death of a Nation, now playing in theaters near you throughout Chicagoland, including theaters near me, downtown in Streeterville, and I look forward to seeing it. Dinesh D'Souza, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the film.
If I may say, deathofanationmovie.com. You plug in your website, boom, it'll tell you where the movie's playing, and please go see it this week.
There you go, deathofanationmovie.com. Thanks for reminding me about the website. Appreciate that. Thank you, Dinesh.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, Troy Balderson, who won that key congressional race in Central Ohio, Ohio 12, on Tuesday.
Is it official?
Well, it's official for me. He's going to end up being the winner. But here's the thing. Trump taking credit for it. But the man who perhaps deserves credit,
who?
Joe Manchin, the Green Party candidate, who got 1,127 votes and prevented an automatic recount. probably taking mostly votes away from the Democrat. Joe Manchin, the Green Party candidate, says he is descended from aliens. He says his ancestors came from a distant planet.
Oh, my gosh. People probably didn't even know who they were voting for.
And hails from the town Hell, Michigan.
I've been to Hell, Michigan.
Yeah.
You go there when it's hot as hell and when it's cold as hell.
And apparently if you're from a distant planet.
Yeah. Wow.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Nobody is insulated from the highest property taxes in the nation. Not even a newly minted Hall of Famer, Amy.
Oh, no.
Brian Urlacher just inducted into the Football Hall of Fame in Canton over the weekend. Gave a great speech.
Oh, he did. It was good. I cried. He tried not to. He's like, I'm not going there.
You know what's making Brian Urlacher cry?
What?
He can't sell his home in Mettawa.
That where Bill Curtis lives with Donna.
I don't know. Does he?
Yeah.
There's only about 600 residents up there. Brian's brother, Casey's the mayor. And Brian, in 2004.
Do we have Brian or Urlacher's property taxes?
We do.
This is great.
He paid $2.3 million in 2004 for the 11,000 square foot, 7-bedroom, 5-bath home with two pole barns and a 2-story playhouse. That's the equivalent of $3.08 million in today's dollars, 14 years ago. The home is currently listed for sale.
For how much?
$2.69. So he paid in constant dollars, 2018 dollars, $3.08. He's selling it for $2.69. That's down from $3 million when he originally listed the home May of last year. Ooh. His property tax bill, $45,000 a year, up 64% from when he first bought the home.
He's doing those hair commercials.
Well, he's
got to pay his property taxes.
Exactly. He had to
put those plugs in. I need to pay for my property taxes.
This is how serious it is. You have a Hall of Fame
year.
Hall of Fame linebacker who had to have a field planted on top of his head just to make his nut. You know what I mean?
There you go, stealing my lines again.
Urlacher spends most of his time in Arizona. He's got a 4,000-square-foot home in the Citrus Preserve subdivision in Chandler, Arizona.
Oh, that's a nice area.
Is that near your
No, it's near Phoenix. It's a suburb of Phoenix.
Yeah.
How much property taxes? Wait, give me the deets, and then I'll tell you how much he's paying.
Well, I'm going to make you do math. This will be fun.
Oh, boy.
You ready? Get out your calculator.
Oh, no.
Come on.
If it's hit long division, I can't do it.
Well, you can't even do it with a calculator?
Fine. All right. Hold on. I got to find that app on
my phone.
All
right. So in Chandler, Arizona.
Okay. Yes, I've got my calculator.
He paid $1.2 million in 2007. Today, the property tax bill there is $6,900.
My mom's is 800. So, all right,
6,900
for the whole kit and caboodle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he has young kids. I mean,
got 3 kids. We saw him on display at the Hall of Fame induction ceremony.
Well, where are they going to live?
Pulling them with
out
him?
Of school. All right.
So,
all right, but that's not the point. Yes.
By the way, his home in Mettawa. Originally built in 1987 by no other than
who?
Richard Marx, the singer.
I know Richard Marx.
You do?
I sang with him.
64%
Hold on to the night. Who? Hold on to the memory.
Yeah.
I bet these young
Hold
cats
on to that
in the,
note.
In the production booth over there probably have never heard of Richard Marx.
I used to have the same haircut. Here's the thing. $45,000 property tax bill, up 64% from 14 years ago. He, in addition to selling his home, and I know, this is downtown problems because Brian Urlacher's got a lot of money and all that. But nonetheless,
well, it's still
a hammering.
It's a millions of dollars. And, yeah.
He's selling his property for effectively $400,000 less than he paid for it 14 years ago. Nice return. And in the interim, during those 14 years, he's paid more than $600,000 in property taxes. So
schools
an increase,
are good there.
Selling it for 13% less than he paid for it, while property taxes are 64% more than when he bought it. And, of course, the two are related, and I don't know why more people don't understand how they're inversely related. I really don't. But they don't, and it's real, and it doesn't matter how rich you are, you're going to take it in the pants here. I honestly talk to people all the time about this because I'm so, you know, obsessed about it, but you can't make it make sense to buy property in this state.
No. And then you try to reduce. So I've tried to, on my own, reduce my property taxes, and then I went with a law firm.
Madigan, Getzendaner?
Right. No, I went with somebody else. And I got the letter yesterday. Sorry. We tried your case in front, and they said no.
Really? You couldn't get it reduced?
Mm-mm.
You had the wrong attorney or, you know, political functionary.
Maybe they saw my name like, oh, yeah, Jacobson. Yeah.
No. That's, yeah.
Yeah, request denied.
Probably.
Yeah, I got the letter yesterday, and then they put a copy of the response.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Who wants to buy Brian Urlacher's home, $2.695 million? With a $45,000 property tax bill up there in scenic Mettawa. Take your calls. I mean, the least we can do is try and help Urlacher sell his home so he can get out of here, too, as thanks for his Hall of Fame years in Chicago.
Yeah, I don't want him to leave, so maybe I don't want his house to be sold.
Too late. He's gone. He's in Arizona. He's just trying to dump this property. How long did it take Jordan to dump? I mean, that's really... kind of in the stratosphere, but right. How long did it take Jordan to sell his property in Highland Park years after he left?
Isn't it still for sale? Or did somebody finally buy it?
You're right. It may be. I don't know.
Thing's a juggernaut. Can you imagine the property taxes on that place? Oof.
Sean in Elmwood Park. He's a real estate guy.
Hi, Sean.
You know what? Hi, Amy. And, you know, I've got a little advice for you, Amy. During the workout, I was listening. I didn't realize that was LaShawn Ford, and he used Durkin to get him off of his financial malfeasance, because he's a real deal scumbag. And if he can get LaShawn Ford off, he could definitely lower your property taxes. And ironically, the reason that Urlacher can't sell his house is because of politicians like LaShawn Ford, who it's not anybody's fault but the other people why the system is failing. And you know what the system needs? Just ask LaShawn. It needs more money. Like the gambling boat did every time he went to it. It needed more money. And it didn't care that it got it from his campaign fund. That was just a little bookkeeping error. See, the problem is we have these politicians who come on and they're wonderful. They have all the answers. And it's society's problem. And it's you and Hinsdale why the kids in Chicago are killing each other. It's your fault in LaGrange and Lombard. You're the problem. You just don't give enough money to the system that steals it, that misappropriates it, that hides felons, whether convicted or not, LaShawn, with your donation. What are you down a little bit on the Bears game? Take it out of the campaign fund. Scumbag. And the system that gets them off is the reason that they keep failing, because they don't care, the scumbags in it. They're wannabe gangsters. And if you think I'm wrong, look at how LaShawn lives, like a real captain of industry. He couldn't make a nickel out of four pennies.
Well, thanks for the call, Sean. I mean, on LaShawn Ford, I think he's a nice guy, and I don't think he lives like royalty.
No.
But I do think he's just not willing to go where he knows we need to go. I think he just pulls up short from what really needs to happen, because he's sort of tethered to the Chicago Democrat way. And you have to have some people, and LaShawn probably holds out as much promise as anybody, break from that, who have credibility in communities like the West Side and the South Side, and say, look, let's just admit what is obvious at ground level. What we have proposed on the left, we've done. every policy that we said should be pursued has been pursued in Chicago, and it's a catastrophe. And we have to chart a completely different course. You don't have to call Republican. You don't have to call conservative. Just focus on the substance of the policy. But it needs to be a paradigm shift. And I just don't think LaShawn is ready to go there, even though I like him. And I think he's ready to talk about property taxes and school funding and how that happens. But in terms of admitting what the evidence suggests, I just don't think he's ready to fully do that. Scott in Aurora, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, I just want to know if Urlacher knew or if his property taxes were anywhere near what he's paying now. Because if it was, is it just something that he didn't even think about when he bought the house? I mean, it's like stepping in a pile of dog poo knowing it's there, you know?
So here's the deal. 2004, when he bought the house, $28,000.
Okay, so big difference. Right,
yeah, it's 64% over the course of the time he owned the home. And, I mean, look, there's a lot of people who are unsuspecting, a lot of people that are still unsuspecting, don't listen to this show, who are going to have a great awakening when they go to sell their home or try and capitalize it in some material way. Thanks for the call, Scott.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Jeff and Gurnee, update on Michael Jordan's house.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
Hi.
Obviously, you guys know I'm moving to Texas, and while looking for a house, I get these Zillow things, and they say, okay, this is available in your area. Jordan's house came up. It's $14.8 million. Tax assessment was $1,055,000, and then taxes were $117,000 a year.
And that's down from north of $20 million.
Oh yeah.
Initially, yeah.
Thanks for taking my call. Talk to you soon.
Thanks,
they could
Jeff.
Turn that into a park district. I mean, it's so big and it's got a basketball court. I got plans for that place.
Yeah.
Movie theater. You could charge people. You can have a basketball league.
Redevelop Michael Jordan's house into some government enterprise. That sounds about Highland Park speed. Mike in Lake Forest.
You know, you could have written the op-ed in Wall Street Journal on Monday. The stealth pension mortgage on your house.
Yeah, that's
is
right.
Real estate taxes.
Yeah.
Milton Friedman said, if you don't like your state, you can avoid sales tax and income tax by leaving. But the tax on your home is what's going to kill you. It's right on point, and it's written by a professor from liberal Claremont College in California. You can't avoid what you're saying, and I think you got to keep it up, and maybe people will wake up.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, elderly woman in Houston shot a bicyclist. That was good enough for me to call it a good shoot.
Oh, yeah, because you hate those road warriors.
Didn't even have to read the details, but the details certainly justify the shooting. A woman in her 60s taking out the trash in a neighborhood in Houston spotted a man riding his bike and masturbating. She yelled at him to stop the lewd act of riding his bike, but he
put
persisted.
Put some pants on.
Well, I don't know if he had pants on or not. He followed her, the masturbating bicyclist, followed her to her Southeast Side Houston home and tried to break in, looking for some Kleenex maybe. I don't know. Maybe that his stuff knows. The woman opened fire on the masturbating man I don't know if he was masturbating when he was trying to break in as well, but.
Never stopped to take a break.
She opened fire and striking the man in the chest. He immediately ran back to his bike. I don't know if he used both hands. Managed to pedal a few feet away from the house before collapsing. He is expected to survive.
Familiar with the situation? I had a similar situation in Tucson.
Were you the cyclist or the shooter?
No, I was on a bike, and this guy came up to me on a bike, and he was completely naked and masturbating.
You ever seen a grown man naked?
Yes, she has.
And
you said,
pushed him. That's going to leave a mark. He had some road rashes, and then I had to pick him out in a lineup in Tucson. I was riding down Speedway.
Why didn't you shoot him?
Because I didn't have my gun on me.
Mm-mm.
I didn't expect that to happen. I'm like, hello? That's a different pickup line.
I like to take in the hard line with bicyclists.
I see what you did there, Dan. She didn't get it. I see what you did there about the bicyclist. Yeah. I got you.
Thank you very
much. Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. I know you're tired of it, but the blue wave is coming. Let's examine it when freedom returns at 5.
Dan and Amy, Trump administration announcing yesterday that it's going to impose new sanctions against Russia in response to the attempted assassination in March of a former Russian spy living in England, as well as that individual's daughter. Any attempt by an American company to obtain an export license to sell anything with potential national security purpose, things like gas turbine engines, electronics, integrated circuits, testing and calibration equipment, automatically denied under the new sanctions. Exporters can attempt to prove the goods will be used for legitimate purposes, but that's going to be a tough hurdle to clear. So, you know, more sanctions designed to certainly protect our national security interests, but also cripple the Russian economy, such as it is, really a third world economy. Obviously, a misdirection play from Putin's Manchurian candidate in the Oval Office is what I suggest the left would say. The president has said, again, per this announcement, but as previously, and it's a pretty strong case to bank for it, that all of the Russian collusion talk notwithstanding, this is a president who's taken a pretty, and the Helsinki press conference notwithstanding, this is a president that substantively has taken a pretty hard line with respect to Putin and the Russians. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Victor Davis Hanson, National Review columnist and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. His latest book, The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. VDH, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
What about those recently announced sanctions and just the general policy that the Trump administration has pursued against Putin?
Well, I think it's sort of emblematic that whatever Trump says, it's not as important as what he does. And that's been thematic throughout his administration. So Jim Mattis and Pompeo and Bolton are trying to punish Vladimir Putin for the types of things he does in Britain or his interference here. And I don't know, when people call for more tough action against Putin and we have all of these sanctions on him, and we are basically cutting back most of our official and unofficial ties with him, and Russians have been indicted. I don't know, and we've expelled Russians. I don't quite know what more we're going to do, you know what I mean? Because we have no relations, really, with him in the traditional sense. So,
well, and the
it's
other
pretty tough what we're doing compared to what China has done, what we're not doing to China.
Yeah, and on, just sticking on Russia for a moment, interesting Wall Street Journal piece yesterday talking about the new rapport Trump has with Rod Rosenstein over at Justice, Deputy Attorney General. And they mentioned specifically Rosenstein coming to President Trump, wanting to announce the indictments of Russian officials for election hacking that was subsequently announced. And the president saying, yep, green light it, do it as soon as possible, because it would strengthen his leverage in advance of strengthen his leverage with respect to Moscow and negotiation with Putin on matters like Syria and the rest of it. So, you know, it's just even Rosenstein, who there's a lot of antagonism towards on the Hill because of Department of Justice perception, the perception that Department of Justice is dragging its feet with respect to providing oversight committees with documents they've requested on various issues. But and the kind of the working day to day relationship on matters where there's agreement on policies in the country's interests, they're aligned, at least according to this Wall Street Journal recount.
Yeah, I think if this was a normal political atmosphere, the optics now would be people on the liberal side would be saying, stop saber rattling, or stop being so, you know, antagonistic or provocative with Russia. This is not necessary. This is pretty much what we heard in 2009 when the Obama people came in and said,
the Bush administration was too hard and that they were going to reset and that Ossetia was over now and it's time for a new era of goodwill. But this thing has been so, the Russian-American relationship has been so warped now. I think we're going to get into a mode where it just has to be negative for political survival on the part of Trump. I mean, I'm not suggesting that Russia doesn't try to meddle, but my gosh, when we hear that Dianne Feinstein, our senator here in California, had a spy as her driver for 20 years, or yeah. We have 350,000 Chinese, we don't know where they are or what they're doing, and we have this CIA, a member of the CIA just was caught in January leaving the country, and he really was responsible for exposing and getting killed or jailed every American asset in China. So that's a major challenge for us, China. But we're going after the misdemeanor, and we're sort of ignoring a felony as far as espionage, I think.
Well, what should we do in regards to China? What should President Trump do?
Well, I mean, he has a lot of options because Russia doesn't have 350,000 people here. China does. And most of them, not all, but a lot of them are at liberal universities. He could say, you know what, unless this stops, we're not going to renew your visas for your students. We have an enormous amount of Chinese nationals, many of them in the Chinese Communist Party, that are buying property all over the West Coast. He could say, if you're a member of the Chinese Communist Party, member of the government, you're not going to buy property in the United States. And that's aside from the things he is doing with tariffs and trade. But for some reason, that greater threat is not seen as an existential threat in the way that Russia is. And Russia is, in some ways, a bankrupt, enfeebled economy. But it has 7,000 nukes, so it's a little strange that we just keep hammering this nail, which I don't mind all that much, except that it's not a major power anymore. It's only a regional hegemony. And more importantly, it's got 7,000 nuclear weapons, and China doesn't. We have more latitude with China, I think, a lot more latitude to do things to correct its behavior, which is much more egregious than Russia. I'm not just trying to say, well, China does it too, but these are the two major powers that we're worried about as far as espionage. But by anybody you talk to in the CIA or the intelligence agency, it's China, 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 not Russia. Russia's been magnified only because of the 2016 election. And I know that they tried to sow chaos, but they probably tried to sow chaos throughout the political spectrum. And it's become something that's pathological now. It's not in our long-term interest.
How important is the information that's come to light? Byron York at the Washington Examiner first reporting it, at least that's where I first saw it, that Bruce Ohr, Deputy Attorney General at the time, was essentially a cutout for Christopher Steele to pass information to the FBI after his engagement with the FBI was over. And then text messages to Bruce Ohr last in March of last year expressing concern about Charles Grassley, Senator Grassley, looking into communiques and information that was provided by Steele to the FBI through Bruce Ohr, whose wife worked for Fusion GPS, who had retained Christopher Steele to produce the Trump dossier.
Sounds like a soap opera script.
Well, or a John le Carré novel, one of the two. How do you receive that?
Well, I just think I react the way most of your listeners do, that here we have the fourth ranking official at the Department of Justice after the election. He's colluding with the FBI to undermine President of the United States, and he's doing that because the source that the FBI has apparently paid in some measure has been discredited, and yet that source is still eager to undermine the presidency. So he's using his wife, who works for this source, to be a conduit back and forth with the FBI, who officially has said that they've severed ties with him. And what's the ultimate purpose? The ultimate purpose is to take rehabilitate a dossier that's already, the FBI says, unverified. But some people in the FBI don't believe it's unverified, and they're working with an official in the Trump administration
secretly and apparently against protocol, because they fired Steele and they've told a FISA judge that they fired him, but apparently they haven't fired him. And they're doing this for what? To undermine the elected president of the United States. And he didn't disclose on any federal form that his own wife was working for Fusion GPS, nor does he disclose to his superiors, at least we're told, that he had a meeting with people affiliated with the dossier. So if this was, again, I don't want to be U2 type of argument, but if this was a normal political atmosphere and we found out that somebody was doing this in the Obama administration to undermine Barack Obama, it would be on the front page of the New York Times, and there'd be calls for a special counsel to investigate this.
Now, yesterday, President Trump's lawyers sent Mueller a counteroffer for interview terms, and it's still on the table, a possible face-to-face between President Trump and Mueller. Do you think that should ever happen?
I don't. I think that Mueller's had over a year and a half now. We haven't found any collusion. That was his original mandate. So I know that Paul Manafort's a shady figure, probably. I don't want to prejudge him before the trial's over. But what we're seeing with Paul,
yeah.
He's going down every cul-de-sac he can to find some scalp to justify his failed collusion narrative. In the meantime, Americans want equality under the law. They're thinking, wow, John Podesta's brother, Tony Podesta, was probably as deep in Russian money-making and collusion was Manafort. Zilch, nothing's happened. Obstruction of justice? My gosh, what was Bill Clinton doing on the tarmac with Loretta Lynch, or what was Comey doing by prejudging the Hillary email scandal, or what were they doing by deceiving a FISA judge? Or conflict of interest, what was Andrew McCabe doing with his wife's donation, or lying to federal officials? What was Yuma Abbott and Cheryl Mills, Andrew McCabe? So
the list goes on and on.
Yeah, I think the only way, I don't believe in special counsels, obviously, from what we're watching, but there's no defense against Mueller. All you can do is say, if I was Jeff Sessions, I'd say, we need a special counsel to go after, to recalibrate the email scandal that was never finished, and then to look at the FISA deception, and then to look at the unmasking and the illegally leaking of names by NSC officials based on surveillance. And then we need to find out exactly who in the DOJ, the FBI, and the CIA has lied under oath. We know that Brennan and Clapper have lied under oath to Congress, and they would admit that they have because they both apologized for it, but there was no consequences. So it's really baffles people when they look at this situation. They think, wow, is it a felony or is it not a felony to lie under oath or to obstruct justice or to have these conflicts of interest or to surveil American citizens by deceiving a FISA judge or by leaking names on a surveillance report? And there's no justice there. So Mueller is sort of on a tangent where, again, he's looking for a misdemeanor. There's a felony right in front of everybody that nobody's addressing.
He is Victor Davis Hanson, National Review columnist, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and the author of his latest book is The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. VDH, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.